This is a special Uncommon Sense podcast for 3RRR FM with Amy Mullins. The interview you're about to hear is with Greg Jericho. Greg is Chief Economist at the Australia Institute and the Centre for Future Work. He joined me to talk about the latest in federal politics and the economy. Greg talks about the current status of so-called tax reform in Australia. He takes us through the federal Labor government's changes to the Stage 3 tax cuts and what they really mean. Do they redistribute wealth better? And how are people on low and middle incomes affected? We also talk about inflation, interest rates, and the extent of the RBA's role in controlling this.
And I'm joined right now, in fact, by Greg Jericho, who I've been absolutely dying to talk to on the radio, and now I finally get the chance to do that. It's very exciting for me, and I know it will be very rewarding for all of us who get to hear him speak. Greg is Chief Economist at the Australia Institute and the Centre for Future Work. He has a column for The Guardian Australia, which he's had for quite a while now, Grogonomics, where he has been writing about Stage 3 tax cuts probably till he's blue in the face. So hopefully he won't have to talk about it too much longer, but we are going to cover that topic and really get into what it means for all of you listening today. And we're also going to talk about inflation and interest rates. And we're also going to talk about the role of the RBA in its trying to control inflation. Greg's just written a column about inflation and interest rates and CPI. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about housing if we get to it. So we are going to do that, and we're also going to say a big thank you to Greg for taking the time out of his day to speak with us. Hi there, Greg, and thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Hi, Amy. Absolute pleasure to chat with you this morning.
It's really great to talk with you, and I honestly feel like the last time I spoke with you was a very, very, very long time ago in terms of an in-person conversation. You were in Melbourne maybe for the Melbourne Writers Festival forever ago.
Yeah, I reckon 13 years ago or something like 2011.
How
2011 maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like incredible. You were talking maybe and we had like a brief hug to say hello, and we met online, I was saying at the start of the show, Greg, as both pseudonym Twitter people. So, you know, we both had pseudonyms, although you were far more famously pseudonymous than I was, and wrote a book really about all of the bloggers in politics at the time. So people should check out your book, The Rise of the Fifth Estate, of which I was lucky to be in it. But, you know, you started out really where I started out, blogging and writing about politics in, you know, was it 2010?
Yeah, started the blog.
The election was...
It was 2008 and, yeah, really came to prominence in 2010 when I started calling out the press gallery for how they were covering the election at that time, which people who observed the last election in 2022 probably won't believe, but actually things can be worse than even that.
Yeah.
it's a bit sad. I keep sort of – I could pretty much repost the things I criticised back in 2010, and they unfortunately haven't aged a hell of a lot. But
You got in a lot of trouble too for, you know, criticising them.
Yeah, well, they some members of the press gallery are notoriously thin-skinned, and they didn't like being told that they really don't what they're doing is offering no value to anybody, and they might as well be sacked, essentially. so they didn't particularly like that, and being a public servant at the time and a pseudonymous blogger, the Australian decided to find out who I was and try and out me, and it was a fun period of my life.
Yeah, no, I remember it well. This is weird that my long-term memory feels more vivid than my short-term right now. but it was good times. I feel like it was a bit more exciting. Certainly Twitter was a different place then as it is now, but it still has a lot of value, I think. So I'm not going to diss Twitter like everyone else likes to do at the moment. Greg, there's so much to talk about. We are actually going to have to go back into our long-term memory a bit to talk about Stage 3, because this does take us back to an era when Scott Morrison was not actually Prime Minister but Treasurer at the time. And, you know, even before that, there were discussions around quote-unquote tax reform in Australia. We did have an almost decades-long coalition government, so there was a lot of context around this discussion and this debate at the time. Could you take us back to then, where these tax, I don't want to call them reforms, because at the time I don't really feel like they're, I don't know, worthy of the name of a reform, because we've had so many reviews into the tax system proposing much more bold and ambitious reforms. But could you take us back to this period where these tax cuts arose?
Yeah, I mean, and you're right not to use the word reform. Reform essentially means a policy change that I agree with. You know, yes. If you agree with it, you call it a reform. If you don't, you call it a disgrace or something like that. But anything can be a reform if you just want to call it that. There is no economic textbook definition of what a reform is. It's just a change that you like. Yeah, it was – I can remember when I'm pretty sure it was the 2018 budget. I always get confused whether it's 18, 19, 17, 18, but it was. I'm pretty sure it was the 2018 budget. I can remember being in the budget lockup, and there had been a lot of sort of rumours that there were going to be tax changes and things being done. And one of the long-term projects of Conservative governments and has been a flat tax, where essentially everyone pays the same marginal tax rate. And the reason why conservatives and liberal governments and conservative economists and conservative media people love that is a flat tax invariably means a massive, huge tax cut for the wealthy. You can use any type of spin you want and call it reform and talk about things like bracket creep, but essentially what they were after was a big tax cut for the richest. And I can remember being in the budget lockup, and they had the tax policies, and there was stage one and stage two, and they were okay. The problem was a lot of the measures that were notionally directed at low and middle income earners in stage one were temporary, and they would be replaced by things that essentially cancelled them out when stage two came in. And despite what you've heard Peter Dutton and others talking about, oh, stage one, stage two, they were targeted to low, middle income earners. They weren't really. They involved things like raising the 37% tax threshold from $87,000 to $90,000, then from $90,000 to $120,000. So that only affected people earning more than $90,000. So that's not exactly low and middle income earners. And also changes to thresholds on low incomes, they cascade all the way up, and they rich people also get the benefit of them. So, yes, a better way to put it is that stage one and stage two were temporary, and even the measures that affected low and middle income earners also affected high income earners. So the difference between you can't really say it would target them. It just also applied to lower middle income earners is probably a nice way of saying it. So they were the first two changes, and they were actually budgeted in the budget papers. The budget papers generally go for 4 years. And so they were all in there. And then there was this stage three, which I can remember seeing and my jaw kind of hit the floor, because it was essentially going to bring in a quasi-flat tax. But which was obviously going to be a massive tax cut for the rich, but it wasn't actually in the budget papers, because it was due only to come into effect, you know, 6 years' time. And because the budget papers only had cover 4 years, there weren't any costings for it and everything. And I can remember thinking, oh, well, obviously that's just their plan. They're not going to legislate it because there's no costings or anything. And then they did legislate it. So what it really was, it was about the end game being stage three of handing this massive high income tax cut that was going to be permanent. And the way they knew that would be unpalatable if they did it, Scott Morrison knew there was no way you could sell that. So what they did was they initially started with these stages one and two to try and disguise the fact that the end game was really about a high income tax cut, and tried to sort of use a bit of subterfuge and say, oh yes, but everyone's doing so well out of stages one and two. And it really all started there. I started sort of writing pretty much from then. saying this is a disgrace and we need to do something about this. And, yeah, it's quite incredible that here we are 6 years later and it is dead.
Such a long road. I'm so glad I'm not going to have to say stage three anymore. I'm sure you're excited you won't have to write it. It's very exciting.
Well, I mean, even the Liberal Party seem to now have completely dumped it. They don't want to touch it. The Australians suggest that they're coming up with their own plan again. And, you know, and this was the whole thing. They were trying to argue that, oh, no, we need stages one, two and three. They all work together. They're all necessary. And if you tinker with one, you tinker with the other. And, of course, during the pandemic, they tinkered with stage two pretty severely. And it turns out that actually, no, it wasn't a really nicely defined system. It was just a high-end tax cut. And as soon as everyone worked that out, they were like, oh, well, actually, we can dump it. And it wasn't that vital to reform. It was just we thought we were going to get away with it, but we didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And you have laid out in clear detail a lot of that really excellent work on stages one and two and how they don't make stage three fairer in your writing recently. And I was looking at, the fact that stage two has obviously already changed some of the thresholds for the tax brackets. So I guess it's great that we're not now completely flattening the income tax system in a sense by, you know, widening it out. But at the moment there are still, I guess, changes that have been made, including the five different income tax brackets, you know, that being the 0 to 18 grand roughly bracket where you're not taxed at all. Then above that, 18 to 45 roughly, you've taxed 19%. 45 grand to 120, 32.5%, 120 grand to 180, and as we're into, you know, some pretty heady figures here, that's the 37% tax bracket, and then over 180 grand, you're taxed at a rate of 45%. So that's the current rate at the moment before all of these changes have been made. And there was obviously going to be that flattening that you've heard of, the conservative dream, which is to make it flatter and more, you know, tax, less for the more wealthy. And one of the arguments that we've heard coming about from the business lobby is that people will be more incentivized to work if they have less tax taken from them. There'll be more increased participation, if you change the income tax rates. Can you tell us about some of these, you know, furfies that we've been hearing about, you know, what they really mean? You've rent reference bracket creep, but there's also that whole thing about, you know, incentivizing people to work, which we hear about all the time. What are they really alluding to, Greg, when we're talking about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lovely economic theory that doesn't really hold up to any sort of shining of light of reality on it. I mean, you know, just think about that line or the spiel that you just went through outlining all the marginal tax brackets, which most people, to be fair, don't know and don't know how they work. For example, you know, I've had many discussions with people who are shocked to discover that, oh, when you go to a high tax bracket, like let's say you are fortunate enough to go from earning $115,000 to $125,000, so you go from the 32.5% tax bracket to the 37%, they think, oh, now everything I earn is taxed at 37%. And it's no, only the $5,000 over $120,000 is taxed at 37%. Everything else stays exactly the same. So it really is this sense of when they're talking about this, incentive and all this, they're operating on this assumption that people are incredibly aware of how the tax system works, how much they are being taxed, and also are these rational, calculating people who, when offered a wage rise, will consider, oh, yes, but if I get this wage rise, $2,000 extra dollars of my wage will be taxed at a higher tax rate. And that means I'm only getting, 73 cents in the dollar for my labour. So I'm not really as incentivized to work that as I am when I'm getting 6.5 cents in the dollar. And so I'm probably not going to work harder, because if I get a pay rise, that won't be really all that great, because I'm better off where, you know, it's all bullshit, to be perfectly blunt. People take a pay rise because they want to get paid more. And even if you do go into a higher tax bracket, you still end up with more money in your pocket than you had before you got the tax, the wage rise. There's really no, you know, the incentive aspect is so overstated. Where it really matters for people when they're thinking about should I work or not is really at the lower end of the scale, where you are more likely to say be on job seeker. And so you're still on jobs, you know, because when you get a job, as many listeners will know, when you get a job, it's not like you suddenly get no job seeker. It's tapered by a certain, you know, once you earn over a certain amount, you lose, you know, a percentage of job seeker for every dollar extra you earn over that amount. And when that interacts with the tax system, and also when you've got things like childcare support, when you've got other, you know, family tax benefit interactions, there can be occasions where it actually isn't better for you to work more hours, because the dollars that you will lose in benefits won't be made up by the income you earn. That's really at the low end of the scale, and we see it mostly for couples with young children, and with talking, to be honest, mostly women who are working part-time. That's where the real incentives and labour force participation issues are. No one earning $110,000 is worried about getting a 10 grand or 15 grand wage rise and worrying about, you know, the incentive to work more. They're taking the 15 grand wage rise and feeling pretty good about it. So I always think that these arguments about incentives are really overstated, because when you just have to ask someone, do you know how much of your income is taxed at a certain amount? Do you know what your average tax income tax rate is? Do you know if you got a $5,000 pay rise, what your average tax rate would go up to? And no one has any clue about these things. No one is thinking about them. No one is turning down wage rises. No one is thinking, oh, I don't want to get it, you know, go from working 30 hours a week to 40 hours a week because, oh God, because I get paid more, my average tax rate is going up. They're saying, yeah, give me the extra hours so I can pay the bills. So I really get a bit snarky at these economists and business groups talking about, oh, incentive to work. It's like, if you want to care about incentive to work, let's talk about people on low incomes and the interactions between income tax and government benefits. And if you really want to get into it, let's talk about HECS, because HECS, unlike income tax, when you do go over certain amounts, all of your income is taxed at that higher rate. So you go from, you know, 1 to 1.5% to 2% when you go over a certain amount, and that applies to all of your income. So you actually, it is actually not in your interest, if you've got a HECS debt, to maybe get an extra shift that is going to take your income over, you know, a couple dollars over a certain threshold, because you'll lose all that in HECS and a bit more. So it's those things that are really about the incentives. Income tax, let's be honest, no one cares, especially when you think about what the Liberal Party was going to do with the dropping it and making it a flat tax and essentially getting rid of the 37% tax rate, which at the time applies from 120 to 180,000. You think anyone on, you know, 115,000 is worrying about a wage rise? You think anyone on 170,000 is worrying about getting a wage rise to 185 because, oh, 5,000 of my dollars is going to be taxed at 45%? No, they're taking the money, they're feeling good about it, and they are not worrying about average tax rates at all.
No, you're absolutely right. I should warn those who have a HECS debt if you want to keep your head in the sand and remain happy, don't check your ATO portal to look at how much it's going up, because my sister and I did, and we were gobsmacked at the rates that it's going up now because of, you know, the economic situation we're in at the moment. And we will get to that in a moment, Greg. But yeah, it's a shocking, shocking situation we're in. And something that Australia Institute Executive Director Richard Dennis also referenced in his press club address recently was that whole discussion around student debt versus the petroleum resource rent tax, and the fact that Australia collects twice as much money through student loan repayments through that HECS system than it does through taxing petrol and gas. So, I mean, that was kind of, I guess, a moment of reflection for many people, was to think that all of this, you know, dramatising how much gas, oil and gas means to Australian fossil fuels, and, you know, just how critical they are to the economy, and Richard and the Australia Institute, of which you are part of, are pointing out, you know, that key role that basically this country's, you know, being funded by our university debts.
Yeah, I mean, it's a case like in the Nordic countries, you know, they subsidise higher education and they tax oil and gas. In Australia, we like to subsidise oil and gas, and we essentially tax students going to university. It's, you know, you can argue about whether or not HECS is fair, and certainly I think the thresholds now have taken it to being unfair, because essentially as soon as you earn the minimum wage, you're having to pay it back, which is just, I think, quite disgraceful. But, you know, if you really want to talk about tax reform, you got to look at how much we are missing out, really. And that's the only way you can say it, missing out from tax from the gas companies, who are making stonks of money. And they're making stonks of money purely because, let's be honest, Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine and sent gas prices soaring. That made huge amounts of money for gas companies. Gas companies didn't do anything. It's not like they're out there marketing their product and making a better product. And it was suddenly the exact same thing that they had been selling one day was suddenly worth more the next day because someone decided to do an illegal invasion of a country. Gas companies making money hand over fist, and our tax is not really going up at all. Certainly the petroleum resources rent tax, which is meant to be kind of a tax on essentially super profits by the gas companies. It's only meant to kick in when they get over a certain amount. The problem is, it is riven with so many loopholes, and the ability for gas companies to, in a sense, write off costs and things, that it means, you know, there are some major gas projects where they've told the Senate that they do not anticipate ever paying the petroleum resources rent tax, because they'll always be able to say, oh no, we're actually we're running either at a loss or we're not making profits like that, because they'll include the costs of startup and things like this and get their accountants and tax lawyers at work, and that they never have to pay it. So it's quite disgraceful that Australia, in a sense, we're the largest exporter of gas, of LNG. We export more than Qatar, and yet Qatar raises about 20 times more in tax from their gas exports than we do. It's absolutely disgraceful. We pretty much give the gas away for free, and don't even really sort of force them to pay much on their profits. So I think that, you know, Richard Dennis's example of, you know, thinking how much do we raise from petroleum resources rent tax from the gas companies and compare it to how much students or ex-students have to pay for HECS, it's quite jaw-dropping. And it was one thing. Another thing we did last year, just after budget, I was in the budget lockup and I was looking at the figures. I realised, bloody hell, cigarette smokers pay more in excise than the gas companies do in this PRT. And it was like, wow. You know, same with beer drinkers. It's just absolutely disgraceful that, you know, these gas companies that we all know are doing extremely well, and we keep saying, oh, they're great for the country, they help make us prosperous. It's like, yeah, not really. they don't employ as many people as they ever say they do. Most of their profits are, you know, they're all multinationals. A hell of a lot of their profits are actually going overseas to foreign shareholders, and we're not taxing them in a way that matters. And this is our – and, you know, we're even doing things like giving them tax write-offs for research and development, which you think about, hang on, aren't we trying to reduce emissions? Why are we actually incentivizing them doing research and development into gas exploration? You know, this – it really is an absolutely screwed up system. And so when we're talking about tax reform, you know, stage three was not a reform, as I say, it was a terrible thing. But the real issue is not income tax scales. It is how we are taxing our companies, how we're taxing wealth, things that we're doing in the housing industry, some actual real difficult things. You know, handing out tax cuts is not a massively difficult thing. And it's why governments always like to paint that as reform. The harder things are things where you've actually got to say, hey, this is wrong, this is not how it should be.
Yeah, exactly. And that is what essentially Jim Chalmers and Anthony Albanese have finally come to. They obviously went to the last election with no air or light between the coalition and them on this particular issue. We now finally have seen them change after so many of your columns, so much advocacy from so many parts of Australia talking about this, as I said earlier, till we're blue in the face. And now there are some real changes that are going to affect people. And I wanted to, I guess, reflect on what those essential benefits or changes are, the kind of headlines. But I also want to just reference in or ask you while we're doing that about the low and middle income tax offset, because that went into the night, you know, died a slow death just recently. And that was one of the things that I know was providing some tax relief to people on the lower and middle income side. So when we're reflecting on these changes now to the stage three tax cuts, and what it means for this, the lower end of the bracket, the low and middle income earners, what does stage three, the new stage three, mean in terms of the redistribution of tax for people? And are we still worse off given that the low and middle income tax offset has been, you know, sent off into the night? Is that something that should have been factored into, or has it been factored into in the new thinking about how we redistribute wealth and factor in tax in our income system?
No, the low and middle income tax offset is the tax offset that dare not speak its name. Both parties went to the last election with essentially a policy to let's not talk about the fact that we're both ending it, and that essentially meant a $1,500 tax increase for people earning up to $120,000. It was quite astonishing. I wrote articles about it saying, does anyone realise that both parties' policy is to raise income tax? The low minimum income tax offset was again, one of these things that was introduced in stage one, was meant to be dumped in stage two and replaced by a change in some tax thresholds that essentially perfectly cancelled it out. But what happened was the pandemic came along and the Morrison government realised they can't do that, because if they were going to do that, they would have had a budget where right smack in the middle of the lockdowns, they would have been giving a tax increase to everyone earning over $120,000 and nothing to everyone else. And they realised, well, that ain't going to fly. So they kept the lower middle income tax offset in for another year. Then they extended another year. And because it was a run up to the last election, they even increased it up to $1,500. And then there was no provision in the budget papers for it to keep going. And the Labor Party were like, okay, we'll go along with that. And so it's gone. And you're right. If you include that, I haven't got the precise figures, but, you know, it certainly was a massive impost. And not everyone is going to be better off even with these changes, but certainly they're better off than they would have been under the stage three. And under the stage three, you know, it was a case of half of the benefits were going pretty much to the top 20%, and even, you know, top 20% might be being generous. And so the changes were essentially over the next 10 years or even over the next 4 years, taking about $40 billion and redistributing that from the top to the bottom. Under the old stage three, no one was going to get a tax cut earning less than $45,000. Under the new changes, that $18,200 to $45,000 tax bracket, that's getting lowered from 19% to 16%. And essentially what that does is give everyone earning over $45,000 an extra tax cut of $804. And, you know, it goes for people earning $30,000, it's not that much, but it's, you know, it all sort of increases the closer you get to earning $45,000. And the government has dumped the policy of going the flat tax and getting rid of the 37% tax bracket, which was going to handle those massive tax cuts to the rich people. But what they've done is they've raised the threshold from $120,000 to $135,000, and they have raised the 45% threshold from $180,000 to $190,000. The upshot of all of this is pretty much everyone earning less than $146,000 is getting a bigger tax cut than they would have over compared to the old stage three. Now, not everyone's going to be better off once you've taken into account the removal of the Lomaito. Unfortunately, no one is suggesting that at the moment. I think that would be a good way to actually target lower middle income earners. Of course, there are other things that we need to think about as well, and that is people who are not taxpayers. Yeah. Especially unemployed, and even one thing that hasn't been highlighted yet, but I'm digging into the numbers. There's about 1 million people who are working who essentially are under the tax-free threshold, or who pay essentially no tax because of some other offsets. And so, even around 1 million workers aren't actually going to be any better off from this. And so, and these are people who are desperate. Relying on things like the minimum wage. And so when I hear calls from business groups saying, oh, everyone's getting a bigger tax cut, we should give them a smaller minimum wage, I think, you bastards, no. They definitely deserve a good minimum wage. So, yeah, everyone earning up to $146,000 better off, but we would argue still a lot to be done, especially for people outside the income tax system, and also just, you know, companies, wealth, all the rest.
And Greg, I know you've got to run soon, but I just want to cover off on one of your recent columns where you were talking about CPI and inflation. And we've heard all about how inflation is out of control. We need to target it through rising interest rates. That's apparently what the RBA sees as one of its central roles, even though it's technically not. And you've written a column about how actually inflation is going down now. It's pretty much on par with the United States. What does this all mean? Why is inflation going down? And does that mean that interest rates are going to be put on hold? How is that actually affecting us? Is the reason why inflation going down because we've been hit with so many interest rate rises, or were there other factors in the economy at play with this? You know, is there a role for the RBA? What can you, you know, break that down for us, I guess, in the final moments that we've got together?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the RBA does have a role, but you need to think about what was causing our inflation, and the inflation that was happening here in Australia and around the world, and the fact I even say around the world, gives away the reality that it was due to international factors, you know, things like an illegal invasion of Ukraine that was setting off energy prices and wheat prices, and also the supply side issues that were coming out of the pandemic and going from lockdown to being opening up. And, you know, even you just, if anyone has tried to buy a car in the last 3 years, they were having to wait just about 3 years for the new car to actually get here. There was massive supply side issues that helped raise prices, but it also allowed companies to take advantage of that and raise prices a bit more, protect their profit margins. The lack of competition in places like supermarkets in Australia allowed companies to, you know, everyone knew the prices were going up, so they weren't questioning the fact that the price of bread or milk was going up by a certain amount. They were just thinking, oh, well, that's inflation. And what we've seen in Australia and around the world is that these pressures have eased. The ability, there's been a lot more attention on companies and their profit margins, and company profits are falling again from their massive, or the profit growth, I should say, is falling. Their profits aren't falling. And essentially, the inflationary pressures are coming down. And really, interest rate rises didn't have a great deal to do with that, because the reason the Reserve Bank raises interest rates is because it's worried that there's too much money in the economy. Everyone's going out spending mad. That's causing excess demand, and companies are like, hell, I'm running out of stock. You know, I'm going to have to raise my prices otherwise, because there's so much demand. That really wasn't the case here in Australia. And in fact, our spending, or you look at all the retail figures, you look at household consumption, it's all been pretty bad, actually. In real terms, it's going backwards. And yet the Reserve Bank kept raising interest rates, and thankfully it stopped in the middle of last year, but then it raised them again in November for no good reason. All the figures that have come out since then have shown that actually households were already really struggling, had stopped spending, and now inflation's coming down, and I very much doubt the Reserve Bank will raise interest rates today, and all the suggestions are that the next actual movement will be a rate cut. But I would be very hesitant to give the Reserve Bank too much credit for bringing down inflation, because the actual cause of inflation wasn't due to us, having masses of cash and going out spending. We know that because our wages were going up slower than inflation, so we actually had less money in real terms to spend, and also the prices of things like energy, of petrol, of rents, of insurance, things that have got nothing to do with whether we want more of it. No one's out there saying, oh, I want more insurance, please. I want to use more electricity. Those things that really aren't affected by demand, they were the prices that were really going up the most. And it's a case of now that they're sort of moderating, combined with just the fact we have been smashed and so people aren't going out and spending, is what's bringing down inflation. And, I hope that the Reserve Bank realises that it really should not raise interest rates anymore. There are still some economists out there saying, oh, no, we've got to keep going until inflation gets down to 3%. And I think, it's 4.1% down from 5.4% 3 months earlier. It's coming down pretty fast, actually. It's coming down pretty much as fast as it went up. The more thing we should be worried about now is how work is going, because just because inflation growth comes down, it doesn't mean that all that that price rises of last year and the year before are wiped away. They're still there. It's just they're not going up as fast as they were a year ago, and we need to think about people's wages and where they are. And the reality is, people can buy about 5% fewer things now with their wage than they could 3 years ago. That's a pretty shocking state of affairs, and that's going to take a long time to repair.
Absolutely. And people should check out your latest column on that particular topic, which is on the Guardian's website. It's Australian inflation is under control. Now it's time to worry about the economic health of households. There's some excellent graphs in there, as there always is, Greg. I love all of your graphs. They're so good. And there's one in particular I love about rental prices and how they've risen well ahead of inflation. But then there's a nice little one of Canberra over there. And you point out that it's no coincidence that the ACT has rental price caps, and maybe that is a reason why that has been less than CPI. So many great gems in your columns, Greg. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. It's been absolutely wonderful hearing all your insights, and I hope we get to chat again soon.
No worries, Amy. Really good to chat.
I've just been chatting with Greg Jericho, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute and Centre for Future Work. He's also columnist for The Guardian Australia. Check out his column, Grogonomics, and also find him on Twitter, Essential Following Grogs Gamut is his Twitter handle.
I'm Amy Mullins, and you've been listening to the Uncommon Sense podcast. Uncommon Sense is a radio show broadcast on 3RRR FM in Melbourne every Tuesday between 9 a.m. and 12 p.m.